It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. We're on Twitter at KUOW. My 7-year-old's Christmas list looks a lot like mine at age 7. Hot Wheels, Legos, action figures, a go-kart. He doesn't want a virtual reality headset because he's never heard of a virtual reality headset, which would have surprised me if you, pardon me, if you'd have told me that 30 years ago when Nintendo introduced the Power Glove, the computer game controller you wore on your hand. I thought that's the beginning of a virtual reality future that would come faster than it has, at least as far as it's reached me and my kid. My next guest was involved with the Power Glove and so much more. Jaron Lanier founded the first VR startup in the 80s, VPL Research, and he helped popularize the term virtual reality, and his new book is called Dawn of the New Everything. It's great to meet you. Jaron, thanks for coming in.
Hey, thanks for having me.
By the way, you work for Microsoft now, although you live in Berkeley.
Yep, that's true.
We'll talk more about that. First of all, whatever happened to the Nintendo Power Glove?
Yeah, it was actually sold by Mattel under license from my old company. We sold millions of them, actually. Like, Mattel's stock price went up. There was never any software for it. You know, it just didn't have titles. And it's been a familiar problem. It's something that still plagues us. You bring out a piece of innovative hardware and for whatever reason, the developer community and the original company doesn't get it together to sell good enough software to go on it. I won't mention other products, but that's happened a lot. Uh-huh. And then a generation later, people remember it as this wonderful nostalgia thing, and it becomes like a cult reference point. That,
yep.
And that happened to the Power Glove, and it's going to happen to a lot more VR gear. I mean, it's our curse until we overcome it.
Well, why hasn't virtual reality become a part of everyone's life by now?
Well, you know, this is a matter of some controversy.
Okay.
And there's certainly many billions of dollars have been invested in VR in the last few years. And so there are a lot of people who are kind of on the edge of their seats wondering about this question. My point of view is just that we haven't done good enough software, you know, and not everyone agrees with me. I'll give you just a couple of examples because this is a topic we could talk about for days and days and days and only scratch the surface. But one thing is the whole way we conceive of software in VR is that you like sort of download an experience and then you have that experience as if it were, say, on Netflix. And I think that that's kind of a lonely and sterile way to approach virtual reality. Virtual reality should be more like a cross between Skype and some kind of fantastic carnival where you can turn into any creature. It should be a live thing with real people. And there are people doing that. I'm not saying that's not happening, but it's not where the emphasis is, and it's not where the big companies have invested the most. And, you know, the real canvas of virtuality is not some fantasy world you're navigating inside of, but it's your own sensory motor loop. It's your own identity and your body and how you interface with other people with whom you might share fantasy alien bodies or something. And that is the core of virtual reality. And instead, we're treating it sort of like a video game you can enter, which I think is kind of sterile and cold and just doesn't get at the appeal. So that, to me, is the core problem.
Well, what do you think the highest and best uses of virtual reality will be in, say, I don't know, within, you know the timeline better than me, within 10 years? Help me picture what we're talking about beyond Nintendo and Mattel.
I don't want to let you get away with this
this
narrative that nothing's happened yet, because I do want to point out that outside of the entertainment and consumer spheres, VR has been a huge success, and really for decades. And let me give you the most personal example. Back in the 80s, I had the tremendous honor of being able to co-create the first real-time surgical simulator, and that was with Stanford Med, and particularly with a surgeon named Joe Rosen at Stanford. So in the last few years, my wife's been battling cancer successfully, and so we're happy. But she had an elaborate and difficult surgery that had been designed in a simulator that was a descendant of the one we built. And then the surgeon was trained by somebody who was trained by my old partner, Joe, and trained for the surgery in a descendant of our simulator, and my wife came out great. And the same condition would have had much, much worse odds only 10 years ago. So this stuff, I'm almost crying right now. I'm sorry. This stuff really comes around. Like, we have succeeded on so many levels. And so we can't only focus on the consumer and entertainment side of things. So I really do want to emphasize that. But as far as—
Absolutely. This is what I want to know.
Yeah, yeah. But okay, if we're going to talk about the consumer and entertainment thing in 10 years, well, look, what I hope is that people find— I guess the easiest way to put it is a continuation of the imaginative side of early childhood that we let go of so much. What I love about virtual reality is it gives you a sort of a freshening of the senses. Like you're so used to just being in normal reality, but with virtual reality, you experience this alternative and you can do it socially with other people. And it gives you a point of comparison. And so you start to perceive everything anew. It makes everything fresh. My favorite trick in the old days was to sneak a rose or some other beautiful natural thing in front of somebody while they were in the headset. And then when they came out of virtual reality, they'd see this thing. And it just like pops into this super reality because all of a sudden you're seeing it with freshened senses. You know?
You do that in the forest, don't you bring the Microsoft HoloLens into the wilderness?
Yeah. So this is a really interesting thing. You know, before HoloLens, which is a headset we made at Microsoft, there hadn't really been a usable mixed reality device. And so mixed reality, it's another one of my old terms, actually. And it refers to a situation where you can see both the real world and virtual stuff at the same time. And so we finally have this thing that's wireless. You can walk around and add ornamentations to the world. And the question is, what do you do with it? And I've been really interested in adding stuff to something and then taking it away and seeing that thing better. So it's almost a negating way of using the device, and yet it's so powerful. So you take it into a forest, you ornament some trees, and then you take it away. And
ornament some trees. Help me picture what you're picturing.
Well, I mean, one of my favorite things is one of my students made this thing with HoloLens where you can throw globs of different kinds of goop on things like trees, and then it'll sort of start sliding down, and then you can just like glob up everything, and then you can spray paint it, then you can like sort of vandalize it with virtual toilet paper and strings, and you can put up ornaments and lights. You can just do all kinds of crazy stuff to the world.
Easier to clean.
What?
Easier to clean than,
well,
than real toilet paper.
No, instant to clean. But what's amazing, so you might think, well, why would you do that to a beautiful forest? Well, the thing is, first of all, it's kind of fun to do. It's totally harmless. But then when you take it away, you see the forest better. That's the thing that's so amazing, is that this contrast that becomes available. Now, I'm not saying it wasn't available before. I mean, anyone can use any number of methods that have existed since ancient times to try to become a little more aware of the world, to meditate, to become more attentive. And yet this is, I suppose, a modern echo of some of these ancient techniques. It's just remarkable and delightful.
So to some people who they may imagine a pioneer like you wanting to make virtual reality the ultimate new reality, or to get lost in it, you're actually about it being temporary, about turning it off and
well,
on, right?
Yeah, you know, this is something that I find a little ridiculous. I often run into people in the field who are saying, well, someday we'll be in VR all the time.
Right.
And like, to me, that is just ridiculous. That's like if I went to you and I said, what's your favorite indie band? And then you told me, and then I said, okay, I'm going to hire those guys to be in this cart that I'm going to pull behind you 24 hours a day, and you're never going to stop hearing them. Like, you'd get sick of them really fast, right? I mean, like, or like, let's say you love fine wine, and I say, okay, I want you to be drunk all the time. You're never going to stop. Like, beautiful things are used sparingly. That's like part of what beauty is. Like, you have to appreciate it. You can't just turn, like, if you turn something ambient, what you're saying is it's going to become banal and ordinary. And like, I don't want that to happen to virtual reality.
By the way, you strike me as an emotional guy, you know, and in reading your book, you know, you're very open about some painful things. And again, it's maybe it's ridiculous that I'm even bringing up stereotypes, but if people think, again, we just talked about one, you want us to escape into a hole of virtual reality. There's also this idea that this is some techno nerdy thing. That's not you at all.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. I think that's a compliment. Right?
I meant it as a compliment, a long-winded compliment.
You know, part of what
I like talking to you.
Thank you. Likewise. Part of the project of writing books for me is trying to change technical culture, really. I feel that what we've done in technical culture, and this has been a project that's been going on for centuries. This started with people like Newton. We've invented this artificial voice from on high that I think comes from old religions or something, where we're declaring here's this objective voice that's sort of superhuman, that declares what the truth is. Now, to be technical, we have to be precise. precise. We have to be honest about empirical results. There's a lot of rigor that we have to adhere to in order to not fall prey to fantasies and nonsense. But we don't have to erase ourselves. And I think trying to come up with this sort of superhuman persona is just leads to misery and dishonesty. And I think you can be very effectively a scientist and an engineer without erasing yourself. And so I really want to prove that.
So, you know, I'm sure that a lot of our listeners appreciate the power and potential of VR. You and I were talking a little bit in the green room earlier that I basically always thought of it as video games, which I quit playing in high school. I'm not a learned man. For those listeners, though, who are like me, Jaron,
like the self-insult radio hour.
Well, I'm aware, humbly aware of the level that I'm able to ask questions about virtual reality to you. But will you convey the power that you express, the passion you have in the book for what the potential and the power of VR is? What's it about? Why? Why do it?
Well, to me, VR is another step in humanity's adventure of learning to bridge the interpersonal gap. So another big one a long time ago was the creation of language. And I think this is on the same order, although we're at such an early stage that it feels ridiculous to say that. But I think it'll turn into something as important as language. Now, I think it would be incredibly arrogant and presumptuous of me to sort of outline exactly what I think it'll be. But I've occasionally been arrogant in that way, so I've given it a go. And the way I used to talk about it in my 20s is what I called a post-symbolic communication, where you can think of language as this hack where you use the little tiny part of the world that you can control as fast as you think, which is mostly your tongue and a little bit your fingers, to refer indirectly to all the other things you can't realize immediately because you're so limited as just this little biological being. And with virtual reality, I think we're going to learn to essentially instantly program within it, to improvise within it, to actually create all this shared stuff. So instead of creating symbols of things with our tongues, we'll actually be creating all this stuff that's beyond words. And I think we're going to develop a more intimate and more sophisticated form of connection to each other and society through that. I believe in increasing the depth of communication as a more powerful agenda than increasing like the amount of computation. I think that that's, and it's the other thing about it is it's a kind of a, increasing the depth and beauty of communication between people is a sort of a survivable kind of ambition. If we have this idea of technology as this thing where we become ever more powerful, sooner or later we'll just like destroy ourselves because that's what power is all about. You know, I that's where the game ends. But I think trying to make something deeper and deeper is a different kind of game. There's a wonderful book called Finite and Infinite Games, and switching to this idea of increasing depth instead of just power switches us into a mode of a finite game. So I realize I'm speaking a little abstractly here, but Seattle's a sophisticated town, so hopefully somebody understands me.
Well, is there one? You just said it's beyond words, so that makes it hard to talk about in a radio interview. But is there one example you can give me of what you're trying to get at when you talk about creating something deeper and something beyond words?
Well, you know, one of the things that I'm really interested in is, I guess the easiest way to put it is using parts of the brain that usually aren't exercised that much. So to me, the most sophisticated user interfaces that have ever existed are the musical instruments. And I'm an obsessive collector of acoustic musical instruments to the point of life dysfunction. It's really bad. It's nothing to brag about.
You've played with a lot of very well-known musicians, by the way, just for our listeners. Toss out a bunch of big names. Ornette Coleman and Philip Glass.
Philip Glass.
Stanley Jordan,
yeah. A whole lot. Yeah. And a lot of people. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I've played with famous people. Okay, great. But anyway...
our listeners would know.
George Clinton.
George Clinton. That's
yeah,
right.
How about that? Yeah. Yoko Ono.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
Yoko Ono.
Heard with the Plastic Ono Band.
So I'm sorry, you were saying.
All right, anyway, yeah. So
you're not just some, you don't just play in your garage.
No, I've played professionally. I was signed during the era when that meant something, and I write for orchestras too, all kinds. But anyway, what I want to get at is that when you're improvising on a piano, if you have a good jazz improviser, that person can solve mathematical problems of voice leading and harmony faster than they could on paper. And what they're doing is they're proving that the motor cortex, this huge part of our brain that controls this giant trunk of connections we call the spinal cord, this system can do abstraction, it can do problem solving, and it can do it vast. And so, like, that is this whole, like, this continent waiting to be discovered of a kind of cognition that we don't really tap into very much. And so I've tried to do that with all sorts of things with virtual worlds where people can use their bodies. Actually, the part of the body that I've been most interested in exploring lately is the tongue, because it's incredibly expressive if you can sense it. And we can control all these parameters at once, and with a tremendous cognitive power. We don't know how deep this goes, but I just feel like I've discovered this, or my colleagues and I have discovered this new planet to explore. It's a planet inside our heads, if you like. This whole haptic modality, it's just amazing.
Well, to really inhabit another world, to be immersed, I would think, you brought up the tongue, it would need to be, the world tastes like something, and smells and feels, and as well as, you know, hearing and touching. How close are we to that? To immersing ourselves, are those senses in this virtual world?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story. Once a long time ago, I was giving a talk in Kyoto, Japan, and I was talking about the difficulties of making a virtual food. And I was talking about how you'd have to have this thing you stick in your mouth that could take on the textures of different foods as well as emit the right chemicals. And what I said is, maybe we could conceive of how to build this, but it's so disgusting to contemplate that we must not. And so then I got this note a year later from a research lab there saying, we are unhappy to inform you that we have performed the disgusting feat you advised against. And they built this thing that you could stick in your mouth to simulate food. And it took three kinds of sterilization between users. Totally disgusting, totally impractical. And the thing that disappoints me at the end of the story is we can't find the device anymore, because I would love it. What I was thinking is it should at least be a prop in somebody's video, you know, because it's like it looked really, truly disgusting. I mean, it was a great object. But it is lost to the world, apparently.
Someone had to do it.
Yeah. Well, see, what I found is every time I say something in public about a device that shouldn't be built, then somebody sells it. Like that happened with Minority Reporters, you know, all these things where we try to warn. So now I'll make a prediction here. Now that I've said this thing is too disgusting to build, next year, Facebook, Apple, Google, and Microsoft will all have competing, like, weird simulated food things you stick in your mouth. And they'll be like, you'll have to have an NPR segment, like, comparing them.
On the must-have gifts.
Yeah, that's my new prediction.
Oh, man, there's so many things I want to ask you about. Will you come back sometime?
Oh, yeah, sure.
There's so much more to talk about. You imagine a conversation with your younger self in your book, and your younger self thinks you're a sellout.
Yeah, my younger self was a little unhappy. But see, the thing is, my younger self was rebellious and thought that big corporations were terrible just by their very nature, and had all these ideas that were pretty rigid. So we had to have a little argument in the book.
Yeah, you had a little chat.
Yeah.
That book, again, is called Dawn of the New Everything, and it's by Jaron Lanier, who, as I said, founded the first VR startup in the 80s, helped popularize the term virtual reality. Writer, inventor, musician, yes.
And speaking town hall tonight.
Do you know when?
Oh, well, you're supposed to know. Like, you're the media professional.
10:30?
No, 10:30 is too late.
7:30. It just came through. 7:30. Yeah, 10:30 seemed late.
It's not the usual town hall place. It's at a church, I think. So
University Temple Church.
That sounds right.
I'm being told in virtual reality, it's being downloaded into my oral receptors that it's
okay.
The church tonight, 7:30.
Good.
Great talking to you, Jared.
Really fun to talk to you.
More from you tonight. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle, and we will be right back. Stay tuned. Seattle needs a new police chief. Chief Kathleen O'Toole is stepping down after 3 years. She was brought here to make big changes, and today, Mayor Durkan said the next police chief will be assigned to continue those changes.
The police chief must be someone who sets the tone for the department, but also understands what the job of a police officer entails, so they have the full confidence of the police department as well. They also have to have the confidence of the community, to build trust with the community so the community understands that that police chief cares every day about the public service that the police provide, and also understand that deep relationship, that hat of trust that is important between the police and the community.
How can the new police chief build that trust? What do we want in this new chief of the Seattle Police Department. We're going to put those questions to a series of people, starting with former Seattle City Council member Kirsten Harris-Talley, who served for 51 days on the council and has been active with the Block the Bunker and the No New Youth Jail movement. Kirsten, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Mayor Durkan says to get community input on the hiring of the new police chief, there will be 4 public meetings, maybe more. Is that enough public input?
I don't think so. What I would love to see is a task force put together. I will say I very much appreciate in the press conference that Mayor Durkan put together her commitment and statement that community needed to be prioritized. I think that is absolutely the right direction. And in light of the changes and the consent decree and other pressures that the city of Seattle has to really think through community policing models, I really appreciate that approach and that tone being set early on. But I really think while the city has done a number of community forums over the years, I don't know that those forums have always translated into actionable goals and what it is to actually then implement the recommendations. So what I would love to see is actually a community interface that's part of the hiring process, if that was something that the mayor and others in city governance were open to. I think that could be a game-changing model.
Who needs to be on that task force?
I think we have a lot of voices already in the Seattle area who would be great folks. I think Nikita Oliver with the Seattle People's Party set a really important tone through the primary season about context of policing in the city, how it's changed, and what remedies could be. Andre Taylor of Not This Time, who's also a part of the coalition efforts for the De-Escalate Washington initiative on the state level, I think would be a really welcomed voice. He has firsthand experience as his brother died at the hands of police.
Shay Taylor.
I think his voice would be important. Activists and representation from No New Youth Jail and Block the Bunker that are both, you know, some really sophisticated community-based organizing that was happening, and voices of young people and folks from the communities most impacted disproportionately from policing. And I think also thinking through what it would be to have community members from each city district. You know, we have 7 city-specific districts, and I think policing looks really quite different in different parts of our city. So having a broad representation there could be a game changer for us to understand how policing looks different in different communities in our city.
Before we get to how policing could look different, what did you see in Chief O'Toole that you hope continues under the next leader?
I really appreciated seeing, you know, in my 51 days on the city council, really we were oriented around the 2018 budget. And the overview and executive summary for SPD in that budget outlined some really specific goals that were oriented closer to community policing models. I did not always necessarily agree with some of the decisions that came out of SPD. They weren't always steps that necessarily through my lens and activism and sense of community would be the approaches, but that the goals were there, I think, set a new direction and tone for what policing could look like. The how it is done, I think, are considerations and something that I hope the mayor and others would give some thought to as they're doing the hiring process. But some specific goals about what it was around the consent decree to really bring down some of the numbers of really aggressive policing interactions that were happening in community. They've met some of those goals. Really the orientation around what it is to think of community policing models and non-lethal use of force in the field. There were some set goals there and some trainings that were starting to happen under her leadership. And I also think, you know, we can't ignore the fact that the Office of Police Accountability has a new director who's officially on board at the helm. They're really changing what that community interface will look like. And the Community Police Commission, after our budget process, also has a lot more resources and staffing that will be there to work with community folks. So
okay, and what's a
big solution.
Mm-hmm. And what's one example of something you hope changes under this new police chief?
I would like to see a lot more considerations about how officers are brought in, the dosage of officers brought in, and what communities they represent. I think a diversity in the police force and the fact that they would come from local communities that they're policing in are some of those community-based models that are game changers when we're looking at other municipalities. putting a lot of time and effort into non-lethal policing models and training is a game changer. Right now, the models are upside down, which is why De-escalate Washington is such an important campaign. We have far too much training that's on shooting range and other lethal interaction training and not on anti-bias training, de-escalation training. How do you work with mental health issues? How do you work with other issues that can accelerate in the field if you don't have the training to actually de-escalate those situations? We need to change our training models so that de-escalation is the go-to instead of a force that really leaves, you know, families with loved ones no longer with them and police with a lot of processes and officers having to go home knowing coulda, shoulda, woulda moments of what could have happened differently in the field. We want a situation where everyone gets to go home safe and sound at the end of the day.
Finally, Kirsten Harris-Talley, former Seattle City Council member, there is an interim chief, Deputy Chief Carmen Best, what she's going to serve starting on January 1st. Is that the police chief of Seattle's future, Carmen Best?
I'm looking forward to the answer to that question as much as anyone. I think we're going to learn a lot about them, their approach, what experience they have to bring in. I certainly hope, you know, they're probably going to be considered. I don't want us to forget, you know, O'Toole came out of a pretty lengthy national process that we had to go through, and I would assume that we're going to try to you know, open a wide net again. But certainly if someone local, homegrown, is up to the challenge of what it will be to police in this new environment with some new goals for the city, they're as good a choice as any as far as a process that's really equitable that brings in the right voices to consider it.
Former Seattle City Council member Kirsten Harris-Talley, who's been active with the Block the Bunker, the No New Youth Jail movement, among others, thanks a lot for this time.
Thank you. Bye.
We're talking about the search for a new police chief. The head of the Seattle Police Department, Chief Kathleen O'Toole, just announced she's stepping down after 3 years. The deputy chief, Carmen Best, serves beginning January 1st. She'll be Seattle's first black woman to hold that position. We'll ask those questions of other people as the city looks for what former Mayor Tim Burgess called the most important appointment that a mayor can make. Stay tuned to KOW's The Record. It's KUOW's The Record. We're on Twitter at KUOW. John Hockenberry, Matt Lauer, Charlie Rose. We've heard a lot about these men recently, how they treated the women they worked with and who worked for them, how they harassed and in some cases assaulted those women, and how those women were afraid to come forward because they knew the men held more power and were less likely to be punished as a result. But the workplace wasn't the only place these men had power. They had power over all of us, because they decided what was newsworthy, who got national interviews and who didn't, what questions to ask presidential candidates. They were gatekeepers for national issues and culture. New York Times gender editor Jessica Bennett, thanks for joining us to talk about this today.
Thanks for having me.
Jessica, why is it a problem that these men who mistreated women are also men who decided what's newsworthy?
You know, I think it's just fascinating to think about the insidious impact of this type of behavior. Because if you look at people like Charlie Rose, people like Mark Halpern, they truly were deciding who got airtime, who got press coverage. You know, there was that moment during 16 in the campaign when Matt Lauer interrupted Hillary Clinton during one of the debates. And he got a lot of flack for that on the internet. But it was one of those things where you thought, you know, okay, brush it off. It's not that big a deal. But over time, these things add up. And so the idea that these are the men creating our cultural narratives, gatekeeping those narratives, and not simply in media, but in entertainment and film and television, what is the impact of that on all of us?
How do you imagine that that works with one of these gatekeepers? How do you imagine their history, their treatment of women, what we can guess about them plays into the stories they choose, the stories they tell?
I mean, I've been trying to think about how to possibly quantify this. Mm-hmm. And there's one pretty direct example. So the Amazon guy who was fired, now I'm forgetting his name, Roy Price. He was in charge of greenlighting new series. And so one of those series that he ended up canceling was a show called The Good Girls Revolt. Now, this was a television show based on a true story about the women of Newsweek magazine who sued their employers in 1970 for gender discrimination. I know about this because I began my career at Newsweek, and people were very upset that the show was canceled, but it was only later on than we realized that, oh, this guy is also a sexual harasser, an alleged sexual harasser, and he had the direct ability to cancel this female-forward show, that I think I started to realize, okay, there actually is a direct link in some of these cases.
In the case of Roy Price, how do you think that works? Is it like, well, you can tell a lot about where Roy Price's priorities and sensitivities are, or do you think there's even a more direct link with he's all caught up in what he knows he did in his history of abuse, and that's got an even more direct effect on who he hires, the stories he tells?
You know, I think that the way that we're having this cultural conversation right now is so much focused on the harassment and the assault element, and that is hugely important. But you can't really separate this from everyday sexism as well. Mm-hmm. This is all wrapped up together. So I think it's not really that far a stretch to think that somebody who treats women in that way is probably also not going to promote them. Perhaps they're not going to take women's ideas seriously. Perhaps they don't see the value in female forward programming. And so that's one of the ways that I've been thinking about this. These things are so wrapped up.
You are now a kind of gatekeeper yourself for the New York Times, its first gender editor. And you were telling us earlier you spend almost all your time answering emails from people telling you their own stories of harassment and assault at work. And just the volume means you can't cover them all. How are you deciding how to cover this ongoing story?
It's tricky, and I've been thinking about this a lot. This is a brand new job. I started 4 weeks ago. And
what timing?
I'm sort of in the eye of the storm in many ways. And yes, you know, we're getting tips. We're hearing from people every day, you know, hundreds of people telling their own stories. And so to some extent, I've been just having this conversation with myself. How do we choose what to cover? You know, there's only so many reporters that we can assign to cover things. So what are we looking for here? Is it about showcasing or uncovering these high profile names who can really show the world that this exists across fields and sectors? Or is it about stories that highlight a pattern? And so it's interesting to think just how much power I think we have as media to determine what stories get told. And beyond just that, I've been thinking about who has access to even contact us in the first place. You know, I did a piece last week, it came out, about a playwright, Israel Horovitz, who had assaulted and harassed a number of women, and nine of them ended up going on the record. Well, the way that I came to this story was through a tip from a young woman who knew a journalist, who knew another journalist, who knew me, and I was able to find out about this and investigate it. But the reality is this person still had access to media gatekeepers to see if someone could tell her story. And so I try to think critically about my own coverage in the sense of there are many people who don't have access to media, and so it's our duty to continue to seek out those stories.
Yes, they don't have access. They don't have a famous name to go with it. You think about service workers. I mean, all kinds of workplaces where there's stuff going on that doesn't get paid attention to. Is that an example of something you're doing?
Those are, in fact, the industries that have the highest rates of harassment and assault. So, yes, those are certainly areas we're focusing on. I think that, you know, there was a lot of criticism when the Weinstein story first broke, and it was broken by a number of reporters here at the New York Times. And people said, okay, why is this a turning point? Why is this suddenly a watershed moment? And we were all kind of trying to understand what it was that prompted that. And some said, well, you know, these are wealthy, white, privileged, beautiful actresses coming forward. And so, of course, people are paying attention. And I do think to some extent that was true. But I also think that having these huge names speaking up actually does make it easier for others to understand that they are not alone in this. But certainly, I think that this has to be looked at from every single angle.
So, again, we're talking with Jessica Bennett, the gender editor of the New York Times. She landed that job a month ago, and what timing it's been. Jessica, circling back to our premise, you, knowing that so many male gatekeepers in journalism and entertainment are capable of victimizing or enabling victimizers. So then how do you evaluate the news and the movies that you consume?
You know, it's hard. We've been having this debate for so long about can you separate art from artist? And for a long time, I think that the general consensus was, sure, you know, Woody Allen still makes movies. I was the other weekend, I no longer sleep or have weekends to myself, but, you know, doing work all the time. But I was meeting with a source with regard to this story about the playwright. And we had met for brunch and she had been telling me her story. And then we left and we were in this sort of mall area in Manhattan. And there was a J. Crew nearby. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, okay, I have 30 minutes free before my next meeting. Why don't I pop in and try to get some holiday gifts? And this J. Crew was playing the R. Kelly holiday album. I basically sort of walked in and heard it and was like, oh my God, there's no escaping this, and sort of fled from the scene. But there really is no escaping this. And I guess for myself, like I can't enjoy listening to R. Kelly anymore, unfortunately. I simply can't. Like, I think that we have to, at a certain point, try to come to terms with the fact that these are men who have been accused of doing terrible things over decades and decades. And are we going to still sit back and enjoy their work? I don't know. It's a tricky question.
So finally, Jessica, besides understandably run from the J. Crew pumping out R. Kelly, what can we do in light of the fact that the people who tell us our stories, and man, there's almost nothing more powerful than a story in a way. What do we do with that information? What can we go out and do differently?
I mean, I think that a lot different is already happening. I think that for the first time, maybe in history, we are believing women when they speak up. And that's really different because women have been talking about this type of behavior and this type of abuse for many, many years. And they were often pushed aside, or they didn't feel comfortable coming forward, or they, when they did come forward, they had to do so alone. And so I think that there's a communal element to this. You know, the Me Too, hashtag Me Too movement has really allowed people to see that there are so many others who have experienced similar behavior and feel like there is potentially this army behind them supporting them as they do speak up. But I think equally important is that we are listening when women do talk about abuse and we are taking these accusations seriously. And that is really different.
Jessica Bennett, gender editor for the New York Times. That's a month-old job. And Jessica's also author of the book Feminist Fight Club. It's just great to have you take what little you have of your time and spend it with us, Jessica. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. And we launched a new newsletter. It's called The Me Too Moment, that is aiming to guide people through this coverage. So please sign up.
Yes. In fact, we're tweeting out a link to sign up right now. This is a newsletter to provide more context and analysis of this story. Thanks a lot, Jessica.
Thank you.
More of The Record on KUOW Seattle coming back in a moment. Thanks for tuning into The Record on KUOW. We've been talking about the effect of a toxic workplace on women's careers. What about the physical effects of discomfort in a professional setting?
I vividly remember turning red, and I don't often turn red, and I remember my heart pounding. I remember feeling really confused and hurt and angry.
My guest is Dr. Roberto Montenegro, resident in child and adolescent psychiatry at Seattle Children's Hospital, and he's the voice you just heard. Roberto, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming. Would you please tell us the story behind that reaction we just heard?
Sure. So this was actually around the time that I defended my dissertation, and it was supposed to be quite a very happy and a joyous occasion, and One of my faculty members invited us out to dinner to celebrate. So my wife and I get dressed up in our very fancy suits that I could afford back then as a graduate student. Mm-hmm. And we go to a very posh restaurant. We enjoy the night. We exit and we wait in line like everyone else in the restaurant to get our cars. And there's a couple of people in front of us, and we get up to the front of the valet line. And right as we're waiting, this woman pulls up in her car, exits her car, goes around the kiosk, and hands me her keys. And at that point, like I said in the clip there, I was confused. I didn't really know what was going on. But realistically, I did know. I looked like the people, like the men that were collecting the keys, like the kiosk workers. And I guess she thought I was a valet worker and handed me the keys. So I walked over, handed the keys back to the valet workers. I didn't say anything. I looked at them. They looked at me. And we sort of understood what happened.
Probably not the first time.
It's not the first time for sure. But a few minutes later, that same evening, a few minutes later, another person drives in their fancy car, gets out, and again walks straight to me and hands me their keys. Twice now in that same evening. This time, I think my face definitely spoke louder, and the woman saw my jaw practically drop open. And she took the keys back, apologized, and took them straight to the kiosk person. And this, again, was without me wearing anything that would be confusing for anyone else. And it was just a reminder of being different and being categorized and being perceived as almost not belonging in that setting. And it was quite a difficult experience, given that it was such an important night. And on the way back home, I vividly remember my wife and I were in the car and we were still silent. We were really confused. I mean, here I was, a brand new PhD from a great institution, and getting confused for the valet person still. It was a tough night.
One key to your work is how you described yourself in that moment. Red face, heart pounding, physical manifestations of what was going on.
Right. And that's really what led us to the new interests that we're looking at. There's a lot of literature and research showing that persistent perceived discrimination takes its toll. It's almost like an analogy that the media had been showing around, where if an individual gets stung by one mosquito, they sort of don't react and they just pass the time. If they get stung by another mosquito, they maybe might feel it. If they start getting stung by mosquitoes over and over and over, the body starts reacting to it. They start noticing. It starts hurting. It starts having a physiological response. That's the same type of formulation that we're having with our work in terms of asking the question, what happens to your biology when you're consistently, repeatedly exposed to small, subtle slights that really impacts just your well-being in general, your sense of belonging. And these subtle slights, there are different ways of talking about these. I use the word microaggressions and microtrauma. So it really depends on the audience, really.
What do you mean?
Well, when you hear the microaggression, Bill, what comes to mind?
Well, the word aggression, I think that's got to be a purposeful, hostile act on the part of the actor.
Mm-hmm. And in general, the topic of microaggression connotes certain feelings to the general public, right? I'm curious, what goes through your mind when you hear microaggression besides the definition you just gave me?
Well, I would think what you talked about is a classic example, because I know enough about it to know that it's not necessarily a conscious act of aggression, but the term helps us take it that way, that you described a little slight like that that you experienced over and over again, that's a kind of marginalization. It's a kind of othering. It's a kind of diminishment. You know, it's not just an innocent misunderstanding.
That's absolutely right. And part of the resistance that I received often, especially when I go give talks about this concept of microaggressions, is a lot of resistance from mostly white individuals. And it creates...
I've had that defensive reaction, like, wait a minute, aggression?
Yeah.
So I understand.
Yeah. And understandably so, there are different levels of accepting and having insight into your reaction when you hear someone talking about microaggression. It sort of challenges your idea of being this good person, this politically correct person, this progressive person. And really, it creates discomfort that a lot of times doesn't allow me to have this conversation with individuals. And I found that when I use microtraumas, it sort of takes agency away from individuals, and it allows for a conversation.
You're taking care of me. I'm in my fragility.
I am taking care of your fragility. It's exhausting, Bill.
Sorry about that. Thanks for doing it yet again. What do you say, Roberto, to a listener who thinks, man, we all get our feelings hurt. For your sake, you need to toughen up.
That's an excellent question. I can tell you, after writing the opinion piece where this clip and the interview first stemmed from, this opinion piece, the goal of that was really to try to introduce this concept into the medical journals. And it was published in one of the leading medical journal articles. I was very proud of that. It was the first time that the concept of microaggressions and the impacts it has on the professional and well-being of minority physicians was really brought to a discussion. And
because the medical industry is a relatively white one.
Absolutely. And it's not a concept that, again, it's not a comfortable discussion to have, especially in institutions that are predominantly white, and now not so much more predominantly male, but still within leadership institutions and people of power, like your previous speaker was talking about. Power dynamics are absolutely critical here. So in writing this piece, I was hoping to be able to talk about this. And for every one positive email I got in terms of, thank you for helping me identify what this concept is. I've been experiencing this as a medical student, as a resident, as a physician. I get confused for the nurse all the time. People call me a janitor, just like it's happened to me several times. I get another email saying, you need to toughen up. You're a physician. You need to make sure your feelings don't get hurt. One critical point to our work is to emphasize that microaggressions is not about getting your feelings hurt. It's about the accumulation of these continuous invalidations, alienations, insults, and just to a certain extent, alienation again, that accumulate and they build up and they continue to cause difficulties with just a feeling of belonging and being otherized, like you said.
Doctor, we've barely gotten into the topic of your work, and I want to know more about those biological effects. I want to know more what it's like for you in the medical industry and researching and being and living this at the same time.
Yes.
And I want to know what we can do about it. People who inflict microtraumas, people who have to deal with it. Will you come back for part two of this? Because we're up against the end of the hour, and I have a bunch more questions for
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's my pleasure.
I would look forward to that. Thank you. My guest has been Roberto Montenegro. Dr. Montenegro is an MD, PhD, and a resident in Seattle Children's Hospital Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Program. Great meeting you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. That's what we have time for today. Our show's put together by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Yandel. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for listening today.